the fact that she would die someday, but she clearly would die, and likely was dying. This thinness, this weakness, this evasion, these were questions with one terrible answer which her grandmother refused to give. Luna pressed onward with an ache in her heart.
"Paw," said the crow, "be careful."
"I am being careful," Luna said peevishly.
"Paw," said the crow, "something very strange is happening to the trees."
"I have no idea what you're talking about," Luna said.
"Caw!"
the crow gasped.
"Watch your footing! What do you think I'm trying?"
But Luna said no more. The ground rumbled, the rocks under her feet gave way, and she fell, pinwheeling into the darkness below. Chapter 31, in which a madwoman finds a treehouse. Flying on the backs of a flock of paper birds is less comfortable than you might imagine. And while the madwoman was accustomed to a bit of discomfort, the movement of the paper wings was having an effect on her skin. They cut her until she bled.
"Just a little bit farther," she said.
She could see the place in her mind, a swamp, a series of craters, a very large tree with a door in it, a small observatory through which one might see the stars. "She is here. She is here. She is here." For all these years, her heart had painted the picture for her. Her child, not a figment of her imagination, but her child in the world. The picture that her heart painted was real. She knew it now. Before the madwoman was born, her mother had sacrificed a baby to the witch, a boy, or so she was told. But she knew her mother had visions of the boy growing up. She did until she died. And the madwoman, too, could see her own dear baby, a big girl now, black hair and black eyes and skin the color of polished amber, a jewel, clever fingers, a skeptical gaze. The sisters told her this was just her madness talking. And yet she could draw a map that led her to her daughter. She could feel its rightness in the thrum and heat of her bones. "There," the madwoman breathed, pointing down. A swamp, just as she had seen in her mind. It was real. 7 craters marking the border, just as she had seen in her mind. They were also real. A workshop made of stones with an observatory, also real. And there, next to a small garden plot and a stable and 2 wooden chairs seated in a flowering arbor, an enormous tree with a door and windows. The madwoman felt her heart give a great leap. "She is here. She is here. She is here." The birds surged upward before slowly drifting down to the ground, carrying the madwoman with them, laying her down as gently as a mother lays a baby in a bed. "She is here." The madwoman scrambled to her feet, opened her mouth, felt her heart seize in her chest. Surely she had given her child a name. She must have. "What child?" the sisters used to whisper to her. "No one knows what you are talking about." "No one took your baby," they told her. "You lost your baby. You put her in the woods and you lost her, silly girl. Your baby died, don't you remember? The things you invent, your madness is getting worse. Your baby was dangerous. You are dangerous. You never had a baby. The life you remember is just a fancy of your fevered mind. You have been mad forever. Only your sorrow is real. Sorrow and sorrow and sorrow." She knew the baby was real, and the house she lived in and the husband who loved her, who now had a new wife and a new family, a different baby. "There never was a baby. No one knows who you are. No one remembers you. No one misses you. You don't exist." The sisters were all venom and slither and hiss. Their voices crawled up her spine and wound around her neck, their lies pulled in tight. But they were only doing as they were told. There was only one liar in the tower, and the madwoman knew who it was. The madwoman shook her head.
Lies, she said out loud. She told me lies.
She was a girl in love once, and a clever wife, and an expectant mother, an angry mother, a grieving mother. And her grief made her mad, yes, of course it did. But it made her see the truth, too.
How long has it been? She whispered.
Her spine curled, and she wrapped her arms around her belly as though holding her sorrow inside. An ineffective trick, alas. It took her years to learn better ways to thwart the sorrow-eater. The paper birds hovered over her head, a quiet, rustly flapping. They were awaiting orders. They would wait all day. She knew they would. She didn't know how she knew.
Is...
Her voice cracked. It was rusty and creaky from lack of use. She cleared her throat again.
Is anyone here?
No one answered. She tried again.
I do not remember my name.
This was true. The truth, she decided, was the only thing she had.
But I had a name once. I am looking for my child. I do not remember her name either. But she exists. My name exists, too. I lived with my daughter and my husband before everything went wrong. She was taken. She was taken by bad men and bad women, and maybe also a witch. I am not certain about the witch.
Still no one answered. The madwoman looked around. The only sounds were the bubbling swamp and the rustle of paper wings. The door in the belly of the enormous tree was slightly ajar. She walked across the yard. Her feet hurt. They were bare and uncalloused. When was the last time they had touched the earth? She could hardly remember. Her cell was small. The stone was smooth. She could go from one side to the other in 6 short steps. When she was a little girl, she ran barefoot whenever she could, but that was 1,000 lifetimes ago. Perhaps it happened to someone else. A goat began to bleat, and another. One was the color of toasted bread, and the other was the color of coal. They stared at the madwoman with their large, damp eyes. They were hungry, and their udders were swollen. They needed to be milked. She had milked a goat, she realized with a start, long ago. The chickens clucked in their enclosure, pressing their beaks to the willow walls, keeping them inside. They gave their wings a desperate flap. They were also hungry.
Who takes care of you? The madwoman asked. And where are they now?
She ignored the animals' piteous cries and went through the door. Inside was a home, neat and tidy and pleasant. Rugs on the floor, quilts on the chairs. There were 2 beds pulled up to the ceiling through a clever construction of ropes and pulleys. There were dresses on hangers and cloaks on hooks. One bed had a collection of staffs leaning against the wall just under it. There were jams and bundles of herbs and dried meats studded with spices and cracked salt. A round of cheese curing on the table. Pictures on the wall, handmade pictures on wood or paper or unrolled bark. A dragon sitting on the head of an old woman. A strange-looking monster. A mountain with a moon hovering over it like a pendant off a neck. A tower with a black-haired woman leaning out, reaching her hand to a bird. She is here, it said on the bottom. Each picture was signed with a childlike script. Luna, they said.
Luna, whispered the madwoman. Luna. Luna. Luna.
And each time she said it, she felt something inside her clicking into place. She felt her heart beat and beat and beat. She gasped.
My daughter is named Luna, she whispered.
She knew in her heart it was true. The beds were cold. The hearth was cold. No shoes sat on the rug by the door. No one was here. Which meant that Luna, and whoever else lived in this house, were not here. They were in the woods. And there was a witch in the woods.
Chapter 32, in which Luna finds a paper bird. Several of them, actually. By the time Luna regained consciousness, the sun was already high in the sky. She was lying on something very soft, so soft that she thought at first she was in her own bed. She opened her eyes and saw the sky, cut by the branches of the trees. She squinted, shivered, and pulled herself up, took her bearings.
"Oh," breathed the crow. "Thank goodness."
First she assessed her own body. She had a scratch across her cheek, but it didn't seem particularly deep, and a lump on her head that hurt to touch. There was dried blood in her hair. Her dress was torn at the bottom and at both of her elbows. Other than that, nothing seemed particularly broken, which itself was fairly remarkable. Even more remarkable, she lay atop a bloom of mushrooms that had grown to enormous size at the edge of a creek bed. Luna had never seen mushrooms so large or comfortable. Not only had they broken her fall, but they had prevented her from rolling directly into the creek and possibly drowning.
"Aw," said the crow, "let's go home."
"Give us a minute," Luna said crossly. She reached into her satchel and pulled out her notebook, opening it to the map. Her home was marked. Streams and knolls and rocky slopes were marked. Dangerous places. Old towns that were now in ruins. Cliffs. Vents, waterfalls, geysers, places where she could not cross, and here, at the bottom corner. "Mushrooms," the map said.
"Mushrooms?" Luna said out loud.
"Caw," said the crow. "What are you talking about?"
The mushrooms on her map were next to a creek. It didn't lead to her route, but it led to a place where she could safely traverse across mostly stable ground. Maybe.
"Aw,"
the crow whined.
"Please, let's go home."
Luna shook her head. "No," she said. "My grandmother needs me. I can feel it in my bones. And we are not leaving this wood without her." Wincing, she staggered to her feet, replaced her notebook in her satchel, and tried her best to hike without limping. With each step, her wounds hurt a little less, and her mind cleared a little more. With each step, her bones felt stronger and less bruised, and even the dried blood in her hair felt less heavy and crusty and sticky. Soon she ran her hand through her hair and the blood was gone. The lump was gone, too. Even the scratch on her face and the tears in her dress seemed to have healed themselves.
"Odd," thought Luna.
She didn't turn around, so she didn't notice her footsteps behind her, each one now a garden blooming with flowers. Each flower bobbing in the breeze, the large, lurid blooms turning their faces toward the disappearing girl. A swallow in flight is graceful, agile, and precise. It hooks, swoops, dives, twists, and beats. It is a dancer, a musician, an arrow. Usually. This swallow stumbled from tree to tree. No arabesques. No gathering speed. Its spotted breast lost feathers by the fistful. Its eyes were dull. It hit the trunk of an alder tree and tumbled into the arms of a pine. It lay there for a moment, catching its breath, wings spread open to the sky. There was something it was supposed to be doing. What was it? The swallow pulled itself to its feet and clutched the green tips of the pine bough. It puffed its feathers into a ball and did its best to scan the forest. The world was fuzzy. Had it always been fuzzy? The swallow looked down at its wrinkled talons, narrowing its eyes. Have these always been my feet? They must have been. Still, the swallow couldn't shake the vague notion that perhaps they were not. It also felt that there was somewhere it should be, something it should be doing. Something important. It could feel its heart beating rapidly, then slowing dangerously, then speeding up again like an earthquake. "I'm dying," the swallow thought, knowing for certain that it was true. Not right this second, of course, but I do appear to be dying.
It could feel the stores of its own life force deep within itself, and those stores were starting to dwindle.
Well, no matter. I feel confident that I've had a good life. I just wish I could remember it.
It pressed its beak tightly shut and rubbed its head with its wings, trying to force a memory.
It shouldn't be this difficult to remember who one is, it thought.
Even a fool should be able to do it. And as the swallow racked its brain, it heard a voice coming down the trail.
My dear Firion, the voice said, you have, by my last count, spent well over an hour speaking without ceasing. Indeed, I am shocked that you haven't felt the need even to draw a breath.
I can hold my breath a long time, you know, the other voice said. It is part of being simply enormous.
The first voice was silent for a moment.
Are you sure?
Another silence.
Because such skills are never enumerated in any of the texts on dragon physiology. It is possible that someone told you so to trick you.
Who could possibly trick me?
The second voice said, all wide eyes and breathless wonder.
No one has ever told me anything but the truth in my whole life. Isn't that right?
The first voice let loose a brief grumble, and silence reigned again. The swallow knew those voices. It fluttered closer to get a better look. The second voice flew away and returned, skidding on the back of the owner of the first voice. The first voice had many arms and a long tail and a great, broad head. It had a slow bearing to it, like an enormous sycamore tree, a tree that moved. The swallow moved closer. The great, many-armed and tailed tree creature paused, looked around, wrinkled its brow.
Zan, it said.
The swallow held very still. It knew that name. It knew that voice. But how?
It couldn't remember.
The second voice returned.
There are things in the woods, Glurk. I found a chimney, and a wall, and a small house. Or it was a house, but now it has a tree in it.
The first voice didn't answer right away. It swung its head very slowly from side to side. The swallow was behind a thicket of leaves. It hardly breathed. Finally, the first voice sighed.
You were perhaps seeing one of the abandoned villages. There are many on this side of the woods. After the last eruption, the people fled and were welcomed into the Protectorate. That's where the magicians gathered them. Those who were left, anyway. I never knew what happened to them after that. They couldn't come back into the woods, of course. Too dangerous.
The creature swung its great head from side to side.
Zan has been here, it said, very recently.
Is Luna with her? The second voice said. That would be safer. Luna can't fly, you know, and she is not impervious to flames like simply enormous dragons. That is well known.
The first voice groaned. And all at once, Zan knew herself.
Glurk, she thought.
In the woods. Away from the swamp.
Luna. All on her own.
And there was a baby, about to be left in the forest, and I have to save it, and what on earth am I doing dilly-dallying here? Great heavens! What have I done?
And Zan, the swallow, burst from the thicket and soared over the trees, beating her ancient wings as best she could. The crow was beside himself with worry. Luna could tell.
Caw,
the crow said, and meant, I think we should turn back.
Caw,
he said again, which Luna took to mean,
be careful.
Also, are you aware that rock is on fire?
And so it was. Indeed, there was an entire seam of rock curving into the damp and deeply green forest, glowing like a river of embers. Or perhaps it was a river of embers. Luna checked her map. River of Embers, the map said. Ah, Luna said, and she tried to find a way around. This side of the forest was far more rageful than the section that she usually traveled.
Paw,
the crow said. But Luna didn't know what it meant. Speak more clearly, she said. But the crow did not. He spiraled upward, perched briefly at the topmost branch of an enormous pine. Cawed, spiraled down. Up and down and up and down. Luna felt dizzy.
What do you see?
She said. But the crow wouldn't say.
Caw,
the crow said, swooping back over the tops of the trees.
What has gotten into you?
Luna asked. The crow didn't say. The map said village, which should have been visible just over the next ridge. How could anyone actually live in this forest? Luna traversed the slope, watching her footing as the map advised. Her map. She had made it. How? She had no idea.
Caw,
the crow said.
Something coming,
it meant.
What could possibly be coming?
Luna peered into the green. She could see the village, nestled in the valley. It was a ruin. The remains of a central building and a well and the jagged foundations of several houses, like broken teeth in neat, tidy squares. Trees grew where people had once lived, and low plants. Luna curved around the mud pot and followed the rocks into where the village used to be. The central building was a round, low tower with curved windows looking outward like eyes. The back portion had fallen off, and the roof had caved in, but there were carvings in the rock. Luna approached it and laid her hand on the nearest panel. Dragons. There were dragons in the rock. Big dragons, small dragons, dragons of middling size. There were people with quills in their hands, and people with stars in their hands, and people with birthmarks on their foreheads that looked like crescent moons. Luna pressed her fingers to her own forehead. She had the same birthmark. There was a carving of a mountain, and a carving of a mountain with its top removed, and smoke billowing outward like a cloud, and a carving of a mountain with a dragon plunging itself into the crater. What did it mean?
Caw,
said the crow. It's nearly here, he meant. Give me a minute, Luna said. She heard a sound like rustling paper, and a high, thin keen. She looked up. The crow sped toward her, flying in a tight, fast twist, all black feathers and black beak and panicked cawing. It reared, flipped backward, and fluttered into her arms, nestling its head deeply into the crook of her elbow. The sky was suddenly thick with birds of all sizes and descriptions. They massed in great murmurations, expanding and contracting and curving this way and that. They called and squawked and swirled in great clouds before descending on the ruined village, chirping and fussing and circling near. But they weren't birds at all. They were made of paper. They pointed their eyeless faces toward the girl on the ground.
Magic, Luna whispered. This is what magic does.
And for the first time, she understood. Chapter 33, in which the witch encounters an old acquaintance. When Zan was a little girl, she lived in a village in the forest. Her father, as far as she could remember, was a carver. Of spoons, primarily. Animals, too. Her mother gathered the flowers of particular climbing vines and sapped them of their essences and combined them with honey that she pulled from the wild hives in the tallest trees. She would climb to the tops, as nimble as a spider, and then send the honeycombs down in baskets on ropes for Zan to catch. Zan was not allowed to taste. In theory. She would, anyway. And her mother would climb down and kiss the honey from her little girl lips. It was a thing she remembered with a stab in her heart. Industrious people, her parents, fearless. She couldn't recall their faces, but she remembered the feeling she had when she was near them. She remembered their smells of tree sap and sawdust and pollen. She remembered the curl of large fingers around her small shoulder and of her mother's breath as she rested her mouth at the top of Zan's head. And then they died. Or vanished. Or they didn't love her and they left. Zan had no idea.
The scholars said they found her in the woods all alone. Or one of them did. The woman with the voice like cut glass and a heart like a tiger. She was the one who brought Zan to the castle all those years ago. Zan rested her wings in the hollowed-out nook of a tall tree. It would take her forever to make it to the Protectorate at this rate. What had she been thinking? An albatross would have been a much better choice. All she'd have had to do is lock her wings in place and let the wind do the rest. "No matter now," she chirped in her bird voice. "I'll make it there as best I can. Then I'll return to my Luna. I'll be there when her magic opens up. I'll show her how to use it. And who knows, maybe I was wrong. Maybe her magic will never come. Maybe I won't die. Maybe a lot of things." She helped herself to a portion of the ants swarming the outside of the tree, looking for something sweet. It wasn't much, but it satisfied the edges of her hunger. Puffing her feathers out for warmth, Zan closed her eyes and fell asleep. The moon rose, heavy and round as a ripe squash, over the tops of the trees. It fell on Zan, waking her up. "Thank you," she whispered, feeling the moonlight sink into her bones, easing her joints and soothing her pain.
"Who's there?" a voice said. "I warn you. I'm armed."
Zan couldn't help herself. The voice sounded so frightened, so lost. And she could help. And here she was, all full up with moonlight. Indeed, if she just paused a moment, she would be able to gather it in her wings and drink until she was full. She wouldn't stay full, of course. She was too porous. But she felt wonderful for now. And down below her was a figure. It moved quickly from side to side. It hunched its shoulders. It looked from left to right to left again. It was terrified. And the moonlight billowed Zan up. It made her compassionate. She fluttered out of her hiding place and circled over the figure. A young man. He screamed, loosed the stone in his hand, and hit Zan on the left wing. She fell to the ground without so much as a peep. Antane, realizing that it was not, as he had assumed, a fearsome witch bearing down on him, possibly riding a dragon and holding a flaming staff, but was instead a tiny brown bird who probably just wanted a bit of food, felt an immediate stab of shame. As soon as the stone left his fingers, he wished he could take it back again. For all his bluster in front of the council, he had never so much as wrung the neck of a chicken for a nice dinner. He wasn't entirely certain he could kill the witch. "The witch will take my son," he admonished himself. Still, taking a life. With each moment, he felt his resolve begin to weaken. The bird landed right in front of his feet. It didn't make a sound. It hardly breathed. Antane thought for a minute that it was dead. He swallowed a sob. And then, a miracle. The bird's chest rose, then fell, then rose, then fell. Its wing angled outward sickeningly. Broken, that was certain. Antane kneeled down. "I'm sorry," he breathed. "I'm so, so sorry." He scooped up the bird in his hands. It didn't look healthy. How could it in these cursed woods? Half the water was poisoned. The witch, it all came back to the witch, curse her name forever. He brought the bird to his chest, trying to warm it from the heat of his body. "So, so sorry," he said again. The bird opened its eyes. A swallow, he could see. Athene loved swallows. Just thinking of her made his heart slice in half. How he missed her. How he missed their son. What he wouldn't do to see them again. The bird gave him a hard look. It sneezed. He couldn't blame it. "Listen, I am so sorry about your wing, and alas, I have no skills to heal it, but my wife, Athene," his voice cracked, saying her name, "she is clever and kind. People bring her their injured animals all the time. She can help you. I know it." He tied the top section of his jerkin and made a small pouch, closing the bird safely inside. The bird made a warbling sound. "It's not happy with me," he thought. And to drive the point home, the bird nipped him on his index finger when he let it linger too close. Blood bloomed on his fingertip. A night moth fluttered into Antane's face, probably attracted by the moonlight shining on his skin. Thinking fast, he grabbed it and offered it to the bird.
"Here," he said, "to show you that I mean no harm."
The bird gave him another hard look, and then reluctantly snatched the moth from his fingers, swallowing it in three jerking bites.
"There, you see?"
He looked up at the moon, and then at his map.
"Come, I just want to make it to the top of that rise, and then we can rest."
And Antane and the witch went deeper into the wood. Sister Ignatia felt herself growing weaker by the minute. She had done her best to swallow all the sorrow she could. She couldn't believe how much sorrow hung about the town, great, delicious clouds of it as persistent as fog. She really had outdone herself, and she had never, she realized now, given herself the proper admiration that was her due. An entire city transformed into a veritable well of sorrow, an ever-filling goblet, all for her. No one in the history of the Seven Ages had ever before managed such a feat. There should be songs written about her, books at the very least. But now, 2 days without access to sorrow, and she was already weak and worn, shivery, her wellsprings of magic depleting by the second. She would need to find that boy, and fast. She paused and knelt beside a small stream, scanning the nearby forest for signs of life. There were fish in the stream, but fish are accustomed to their lot in life and don't experience sorrow as a general rule. There was a nest of starlings overhead, the hatchlings not 2 days old. She could crush the baby birds one by one and eat the mother's sorrow. Of course she could. But the sorrow of birds was not as potent as mammalian sorrow. There wasn't a mammal for miles. Sister Ignatia sighed. She gathered what she needed to build a makeshift scrying device, a bit of volcanic glass from her pocket, the bones of a recently killed rabbit, and an extra bootlace, because it was helpful to include the most useful thing on hand, and nothing is more useful than a bootlace. She couldn't build it with the same level of detail as the large mechanical scryers she had in the tower, but she wasn't looking for very much. She couldn't see Antane. She had an idea of where he was. She was fairly certain she could see a blur where she thought he might be, but something was blocking her view. "Magic?" she muttered. "Surely not." All the magicians on Earth, at least everyone who knew what they were doing, had perished 500 years earlier when the volcano erupted. Or nearly erupted. The fools. Sending her with her 7-league boots to rescue the people in the forest villages. Oh, she certainly had. She'd gathered them all safe and sound into the protectorate. All their endless sorrows clouding together in one place. All according to plan. She licked her lips. She was so hungry. She needed to survey her surroundings. The head sister held her scrying device up to her right eye and scanned the rest of the forest. Another blur. "What is the matter with this thing?" she wondered. She tightened the knots. Still a blur. Hunger, she decided. Even basic spells are difficult when one is not operating at full strength. Sister Ignatia eyed the starling nest. She scanned the mountain. Then she gasped. "No!" she shouted. She looked again. "How are you still alive, you ugly thing?" She rubbed her eyes and looked a third time. "I thought I killed you, Glurk," she whispered. "Well, I guess I shall have to try again. Troublesome creature, you almost foiled me once, but you failed, and you shall fail again. First," she thought, "a snack." Shoving her scrying device into her pocket, Sister Ignatia climbed up to the branch with the starling nest. She reached in and grabbed a tiny, wriggling nestling. She crushed it in one fist as the horrified mother looked on. The mother sparrow's sorrow was thin, but it was enough. Sister Ignatia licked her lips and crushed another nestling. "And now," she thought,
I must remember where I hid those 7-league boots.
Chapter 34, in which Luna meets a woman in the wood. The paper birds roosted on branches and stones and the remains of chimneys and walls and old buildings. They made no sound outside the rustle of paper and the scritch of folds. They quieted their bodies and turned their faces toward the girl on the ground. They had no eyes, but they watched her all the same. Luna could feel it. "Hello," she said, because she didn't know what else to say. The paper birds said nothing. The crow, on the other hand, couldn't keep himself quiet. He spiraled upward and sped into a cluster gathered on the extended arm of an ancient oak tree, shouting all the while.
"Caw, caw, caw, caw,"
the crow screeched.
"Hush," Luna admonished. She had her eyes on the paper birds. They tilted their heads in unison, first pointing their beaks at the girl on the ground, then following the crazed crow, then looking back at the girl.
"Caw," said the crow. "I'm frightened."
"Me too," Luna said as she stared at the birds. They scattered, then massed again, hovering over her like a great undulating cloud before settling back onto the branches of the oak tree.
"They know me," Luna thought.
"How do they know me?"
"The birds, the map, the woman in my dreams. She is here. She is here. She is here." It was too much to think about. The world had too many things to know in it, and Luna's mind was full. She had a pain in her skull, right in the middle of her forehead. The paper birds stared at her.
"What do you want from me?" Luna demanded.
The paper birds rested on their roosts. There were too many to count. They were waiting. But for what?
"Caw,"
the crow said.
"Who cares what they want? Paper birds are creepy."
They were creepy, of course. But they were also beautiful and strange. They were looking for something. They wanted to tell her something. Luna sat down on the dirt. She kept her eye on the birds. She let the crow nestle on her lap. She closed her eyes and took out her book and a pencil stub. Once, she had let her mind wander as she thought about the woman in her dreams, and then she had drawn a map, and the map was correct, or at least it had been so far. "She is here. She is here. She is here," her map said, and Luna could only assume that it was telling the truth. But now she needed to make something else happen. She needed to know where her grandmother was.
"Caw,"
said the crow.
"Hush," Luna said without opening her eyes. "I'm trying to concentrate."
The paper birds watched her. She could feel them watching. Luna felt her hand move across the page. She tried to keep her mind on her grandmother's face, the touch of her hand, the smell of her skin. Luna felt worry grip her heart in its fist, and two hot tears came tumbling down, hitting the paper with a splat.
"Caw,"
the crow said.
"Bird,"
it meant. Luna opened her eyes. The crow was right. She hadn't drawn her grandmother at all. She had drawn a stupid bird, one that was sitting in a man's hand.
"Well, what on earth?" Luna grumbled, her heart sinking into her boots. How could she find her grandmother? How indeed?
"Caw,"
the crow said.
"Tiger."
Luna scrambled to her feet, keeping her knees bent in a low crouch.
"Stay close,"
she whispered to the crow. She wished the birds were made of something more substantial than paper, rock maybe, or sharp steel.
"Well," said a voice, "what have we here?"
"Caw,"
said the crow.
"Tiger."
But it wasn't a tiger at all. It was a woman.
"So why do I feel so afraid?"
Athene stood as the Grand Elder arrived, flanked by two heavily armed Sisters of the Star. She was, by all appearances, utterly unafraid. It was galling, really. The Grand Elder knitted his eyebrows in a way that he assumed was imposing. This had no effect. To make it worse,
It seemed that she not only knew the two soldiers to the right and left of him, but was friends with them as well. She brightened as she saw the ruthless soldiers arrive, and they smiled back.
"Lillian's," she said, smiling at the soldier on his left. "And my dear, dear May," she said, blowing a kiss to the soldier on his right.
This was not the entrance that the Grand Elder had hoped for. He cleared his throat. The women in the room seemed not to have noticed that he was there. It was infuriating.
"Welcome, Uncle Gerland," Athene said with a gentle bow. "I was just heating some water in the kettle, and I have fresh mint from the garden. Can I make you some tea?"
Grand Elder Gerland wrinkled his nose. "Most housewives, madam," he said acidly, "would not bother with herbal trifles in their garden when there are mouths to feed and neighbors to look after. Why not grow something more substantial?"
Athene was unruffled as she moved about the kitchen. The baby was strapped to her body with a pretty cloth, which she had embroidered herself, no doubt.
Everything in the house was clever and beautified, industrious, creative, and canny. Gerland had seen that combination before, and he did not like it. She poured hot water into two handmade cups stuffed with mint and sweetened it with honey from her hive outside. Bees and flowers and even singing birds surrounded the house. Gerland shifted uncomfortably. He took his cup of tea and thanked his hostess, though he was certain that he would despise it. He took a sip. The tea, he realized peevishly, was the most delicious thing he had ever drunk.
"Oh, Uncle Gerland," Athene sighed happily, leaning into her sling to kiss the head of her baby. "Surely you know that a productive garden is a well-balanced garden. There are plants that eat the soil and plants that feed the soil. We grow more than we could ever eat, of course, and much of it is given away. As you know, your nephew is always willing to give of himself to help others."
If the mention of her husband hurt her at all, she didn't show it. The girl seemed incapable of sorrow, foolish thing. Indeed, she seemed to glow with pride. Gerland was baffled. He did his best to contain himself.
"As you know, child, the day of sacrifice is rapidly approaching."
He expected her to grow pale at this pronouncement. He was mistaken.
"I am aware, Uncle," she said, kissing her baby again. She looked up and met his gaze, her expression so assured of her own equality with the Grand Elder that he found himself speechless in the face of such blind insolence.
"Dear Uncle," Athene continued gently, "why are you here? Of course you are welcome in my home whenever you choose to stop by, and of course my husband and I are always pleased to see you. Usually it is the head sister who comes to intimidate the families of the doomed children. I have been expecting her all day."
"Well," Gerland said, "the head sister is not available. I have come instead."
Athene gave the old man a piercing look.
"What do you mean, not available? Where is Sister Ignatia?"
The Grand Elder cleared his throat. People did not question him. Indeed, people did not question much in the Protectorate. They were a people who accepted their lot in life as they should. This young woman, this child.
Well, Gerland thought, one can only hope she will go mad like the other one did so long ago.
Locked in the tower was far preferable to insolent questioning at family dinners, that much was certain. He cleared his throat again.
"Sister Ignatia is away," he said slowly, "on business."
"What kind of business?" the girl asked with a narrowed eye.
"Her own, I suspect,"
Gerland replied. Athene stood and approached the two soldiers. They had been trained, of course, to not make eye contact with the citizenry and to instead gaze past them impassively. They were supposed to look as a stone looks and feel as a stone feels. This was the mark of a good soldier, and all of the sisters were good soldiers. But these soldiers began to flush as the girl approached them. They tilted their gaze to the ground.
"Athene," one of them whispered.
"No."
"May?"
Athene said. Look at my face. You too, Lillians.
Gerlin's jaw fell open. He'd never seen anything like it in all his life. Athene was smaller than both of the soldiers. And yet, she seemed to tower before them both.
Well, he sputtered, I must object.
Athene ignored him.
Does the tiger prowl?
The soldiers were silent.
I feel we are moving away from the subject of the conversation,
Gerland began. Athene held up her hand, silencing her uncle-in-law, and he was, remarkably, silent. He couldn't believe it.
At night, May, the young woman continued, answer me, does the tiger prowl?
The soldier pressed her lips together as though trying to force her words inside. She winced.
What on earth could you possibly mean? Gerland sputtered. Tigers? You are too old for girlish games.
Silence, Athene ordered.
And once again, incomprehensibly, Gerland fell silent. He was astonished. The soldier bit her lip and hesitated for a moment. She leaned in toward Athene.
Well, I never thought about it as you did, but yes. No padded paws stalk the hallways of the tower. Nothing growls. Not for days. We all...
The soldier closed her eyes.
Sleep easy. For the first time in years.
Athene wrapped her arms around the infant in his sling. The boy sighed in his dreaming.
So, Sister Ignatia is not in the tower. She is not in the Protectorate, or I would have heard of it. She must be in the forest. And she no doubt means to kill him, Athene murmured.
She walked over to Gerland. He squinted. Everything in this house was bright. Though the rest of the town was submerged in fog, this house was bathed in light. Sunlight streamed in the windows. The surfaces gleamed. Even Athene seemed to shine like an enraged star.
My dear... You!
Athene's voice was somewhere between a bellow and a hiss.
I meant to say,
Gerland said, feeling himself crumple and burn like paper.
You sent my husband into the woods to die!
Her eyes were flames. Her hair was flame. Even her skin was on fire. Gerland felt his eyelashes begin to singe.
What? Oh, what a silly thing to say. I mean, your own nephew!
She spat on the ground, an uncouth gesture that seemed strangely lovely when she did it. And Gerland, for the first time in his life, felt ashamed.
You sent a murderer after him. The first son of your only sister and your best friend. Oh, uncle, how could you... It isn't what you think, my dear. Please, sit. We're family. Let's discuss.
But Gerland felt himself crumble inside. His soul succumbed to a thousand cracks. She strode past him and returned to the soldiers.
Ladies, she said, if either of you have ever held me in any modicum of affection or respect, I must humbly ask for your assistance. I have things that I would like to accomplish before the day of sacrifice, which, as we all know, she gave Gerland a poisonous look, waits for no man.
She let that hang in the air for a moment. I think I need to visit with my former sisters. The cat's away, and the mice shall play. And there is much that a mouse can do, after all.
Oh, Athene,
the sister named May said, linking arms with the young mother.
How I've missed you!
And the two women left arm in arm, with the other soldier hesitating, glancing at the elder, and then hurrying behind.
I must say, the grand elder said, this is highly...
He looked around.
I mean, there are rules, you know.
He drew himself up and gave a haughty expression to no one at all.
Rules!
The paper birds didn't move. The crow didn't move. Luna didn't move either. The woman, though, stepped quietly closer. Luna couldn't tell how old she was. One moment she looked very young, another moment she looked impossibly old. Luna said nothing. The woman's gaze drifted up to the birds in the branches. Her eyes narrowed. "I've seen that trick before," she said. "Did you make them?" She returned her gaze to Luna, who felt the woman's vision pierce her right through the middle. She cried out in pain. The woman gave a broad smile. "No," she said. "Not your magic." The word, said out loud, made Luna's skull feel as though it was about to split in half. She pressed her hands to her forehead. "Pain," the woman said. "It's a sorrowful thing, don't you think?" There was an odd, hopeful note in her voice. Luna remained crouched on the ground. "No," she said, her voice tight and ready, like a set spring. "Not sorrow, it's just annoying." The woman's smile soured into a frown. She looked back up at the paper birds. She gave them a sidelong smile. "They're lovely," she said. "Those birds, are they yours? Were they a gift?" Luna shrugged. The woman tilted her head to the side. "Look how they hang on you, waiting for you to speak." "Still, they're not your magic."
"Nothing's my magic," Luna said.
The birds behind her rustled their wings. Luna would have turned to look, but she would have to break eye contact with the stranger, and something told her she didn't want to do that.
"I don't have any magic. Why would I?"
The woman laughed, and not nicely.
"Oh, I wouldn't say that, you silly thing."
Luna decided to hate this woman.
"I'd say several things are your magic, and more things coming, if I'm not mistaken, though it does look as though someone has attempted to hide your magic from you."
She leaned forward and squinted.
"Interesting, that spell work. I recognize it, but my, it has been years."
The paper birds, as if by some signal, lifted in one great flutter of wings and roosted next to the girl. They kept their beaks faced toward the stranger, and Luna felt for sure that they had somehow become harder, sharper, and more dangerous than before. The woman gave a little start and took a step or two backward.
"Caw," said the crow. "Keep walking."
The rocks under Luna's hands began to shimmy and shudder. They seemed to shake the very air, even the ground shook.
"I wouldn't trust them if I were you. They've been known to attack," the woman said.
Luna gave her a skeptical expression.
"Oh, you don't believe me? Well, the woman who made them is a wicked thing. And broken.
She sorrowed until she could sorrow no more, and now she is quite mad." She shrugged.
"And useless."
Luna didn't know why the woman angered her so, but she had to resist everything in her that told her to leap to her feet and kick the woman as hard as she could in the shins.
"Ah," the stranger gave her a wide smile. "Anger. Very nice. Useless to me, alas. But as it is so often a precursor to sorrow, I confess that I do like it."
She licked her lips.
"I like it quite a bit."
"I don't think we are going to be friends," Luna growled.
"A weapon," she thought. "I think I need a weapon."
"No," the woman said. "I wouldn't think so. I am just here to collect what is mine, and I'll be on my way. I..." She paused, held up one hand.
"Wait a moment."
The woman turned and walked into the ruined village. A tower stood in the center of the ruin, though it didn't look as if it would be standing much longer. There was a broad gash in its foundation on one side, like an open, surprised mouth.
"They were in the tower," the woman said, mostly to herself. "I put them there myself. I remember now."
She ran to the opening and skidded on her knees across the ground. She peered into the darkness.
"Where are my boots?" the woman whispered. "Come to me, my darlings."
Luna stared. She had had a dream once, not very long ago. Surely it was a dream, wasn't it? And Firion had reached into a hole in a broken tower and pulled out a pair of boots. It must have been a dream because Firion had been strangely large. And then he had brought the boots to her, and she had put them in a trunk. Her trunk! She hadn't thought about it again until this moment. She shook her head to clear the thought away.
"Where are my boots?" the woman bellowed.
Luna shrank back. The stranger stood, her loose gown billowing about her. She raised her hands wide overhead and with a broad, swooping motion pushed the air in front of her body, and just like that, the tower fell. Luna tumbled onto the rocks with a yelp. The crow, terrified by the noise and dust and commotion, sprang skyward. He circled the air, cursing all the while. "It was about to fall," Luna whispered, trying to make sense of what she had been seeing. She stared into the cloud of dust and mold and grit at the pile of rubble and the hunched figure of the robed woman holding her arms outward as though she was about to catch the sky. "No one could have that much power," she thought. "Could they?"
"Gone!" the woman shrieked. "They are gone!"
She turned and stalked toward the girl. With a flick of her left wrist, she bent the air in front of her, forcing Luna to her feet. The woman kept her left hand out, pinching the air with clawed fingers, keeping Luna in place from several yards away.
"I don't have them," Luna whimpered.
The woman's grip hurt. Luna felt her fear expand inside her like a storm cloud, and as her fear grew, so did the woman's smile. Luna did her best to stay calm.
"I just got here."
"But you have touched them," the woman whispered. "I can see the residue on your hands."
"No, I haven't,"
Luna said, thrusting her hands into her pockets. She tried to force away any memory of the dream.
"You will tell me where they are."
The woman raised her right hand, and even from far away, Luna could feel the fingers on her throat. She began to choke.
"You will tell me right now," the woman said.
"Go away,"
Luna gasped. And suddenly, everything moved. The birds lifted from their roost and massed behind the girl.
"Oh, you silly thing," the woman laughed. "Do you think your silly parlor tricks can..."
And the birds attacked, swirling like a cyclone. They shook the air. They made the rocks tremble. They bent the torsos of the trees.
"Get them off me!"
the woman shrieked, waving her hands. The birds cut her hands. They cut her forehead. They attacked without mercy. Luna held her crow close to her chest and ran as fast as she could. Chapter 35, in which Glurk smells something unpleasant.
"I'm itchy, Glurk,"
Firion said.
"I'm itchy all over. I'm the itchiest in the world."
"Oh, dear boy," Glurk said heavily. "Could you possibly know that?"
He closed his eyes and inhaled deeply.
"Where has she gone?" he wondered. "Where are you, Zan?"
He felt the tendrils of worry wind around his heart, nearly squeezing it to a stop. Firion had perched right in between the monster's great, wide-spaced eyes, and he began scratching his backside madly. Glurk rolled his eyes.
"You've never even seen the world. You might not be the itchiest."
Firion scratched at his tail, his belly, his neck. He scratched his ears and his skull and his long nose.
"Do dragons shed their skins?"
Firion asked suddenly.
"What?
Do they shed their skins? Like snakes?"
Firion attacked his left flank. Glurk considered this. He searched his brain. Dragons were a solitary species, few and far between. They were difficult to study. Even dragons, in his experience, didn't know much about dragons.
"I do not know, my friend," he said finally. "The poet tells us, each mortal beast must find its ground, be it forest or fen or field or fire. Perhaps you will know all that you wish to know when you find your ground.
But what is my ground?
Therion asked, worrying at his skin as though he meant